whatever you do.
This is VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Richard Green. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he will be speaking with his Russian counterpart in the coming days for the first time since Russia invaded Ukraine. VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, in Washington, has the story.
Secretary Blinken told reporters at the State Department Wednesday his conversation with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will not be a negotiation about Ukraine. While the war will certainly be discussed, also on the agenda is a U.S. proposal for the release of two Americans held in Moscow, professional basketball player Brittany Griner and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan.
We're very focused on getting Brittany and Paul home. At the same time, I'm also focused every single day on arbitrarily detained Americans in more than half a dozen countries around the world.
Blinken and White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby would not confirm reports Washington is proposing to Moscow the swap of convicted arms dealer Viktor Bout for the two Americans. The Russian is serving a 25-year prison sentence in the United States on charges of conspiring to kill Americans, illegally exporting anti-aircraft missiles, and providing material support to a terrorist organization. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, a senior advisor to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Wednesday that Russian forces are undertaking a massive redeployment of troops to three southern regions of Ukraine in what appears to be a change of tactics by Moscow. The presidential advisor said in an interview posted on YouTube that Russian forces have taken over Ukraine's second biggest power plant. Russian-backed forces had earlier announced the capture of a Soviet-era coal fire plant in eastern Ukraine. This is VOA News. The U.S. Federal Reserve has again boosted its benchmark interest rate in a bid to tame inflation. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It's the central bank's most aggressive bid in three decades to fight the highest inflation in four decades. For a second straight time, it's hiking the key rate by 0.75 point.
It's likely that their full effect has not been felt by the economy, so there's probably some additional tightening, significant additional tightening in the pipeline.
The goal is to reduce consumer and business borrowing and spending, thus cooling the economy and slowing inflation. Some analysts, though, worry with the economy already slowing, more rate hikes by Jerome Powell's Fed will lead to a recession this year or next. For now,
I do not think the U.S. is currently in a recession.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Canadian government says Pope Francis's apology to Indigenous peoples for abuses they suffered in the country's church-run residential schools did not go far enough. The official government reaction came as Francis arrived Wednesday in Quebec City for meetings with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and other high-ranking officials. The government's criticism echoes those of survivors and concern about the pontiff's admission of any reference to the sexual abuse suffered by Indigenous children in the schools, as well as his refusal to name the Catholic Church as an institution bearing any responsibility. A study casts more doubt on the use of high-dose vitamin D pills. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has that story.
According to researchers, a new study finds taking high doses of vitamin D does not reduce the risk of broken bones in generally healthy older Americans. The study's conclusions mirror other studies that cast doubt on the beneficial effects of vitamin D. The same study of nearly 26,000 people had previously found taking high doses of vitamin D does not prevent heart disease, cancer, or memory loss. The study, started by Dr. Joanne Manson of Brigham and Women's Hospital, is the largest of its type to track a variety of health outcomes in generally healthy Americans in their 50s or older. It's estimated that a third of Americans 60 and older take supplements. I'm Mike Gracia.
Repeating our top story, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he will be speaking with his Russian counterpart in the coming days for the first time since Russia invaded Ukraine. Secretary Blinken told reporters at the State Department Wednesday his conversation with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will focus on the release of two Americans held in Moscow, professional basketball player Brittany Griner and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan. Blinken and White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby would not confirm reports that Washington is proposing to Moscow the swap of a convicted arms dealer for the two Americans. Reporting via remote, I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Today is Thursday, July 28, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukrainian forces knocks out a Russian supply bridge with a U.S.-supplied precision rocket system.
Deputy of head of president office, Mr. Podolak, said that next time Russian forces would actually be cut.
U.S. President Joe Biden emerges from COVID-19 isolation after a five-day period.
Speaking for nearly 10 minutes in the White House Rose Garden on Wednesday, President Biden declared himself fully recovered from COVID-19 after he tested negative.
And hard-won progress against HIV has stalled, putting millions of lives at risk. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The Ukrainian military has used a U.S.-supplied precision rocket system to deliver a morale-lifting knockout punch to a bridge Russia used to supply its forces in an occupied region of southern Ukraine. The deputy head of the Moscow-appointed administration in the Kherson region said Ukrainian artillery struck the Antonivsky Bridge late Tuesday. He said previous Ukrainian attacks damaged the bridge last week, but the span had to be closed to vehicles on Wednesday. Reporter Anna Chernikova shares more details with Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller.
Ukrainian officials said that this was the last proposition, basically, for the Russian forces to leave, because as deputy of head of president office, Mr. Podolak said that next time Russian forces would actually be cut. So basically, Ukrainian forces are trying to, you know, give this hint to the Russian side that they actually have probably a plan to continue the attacks or to do something additional so that this breach could not be used at all.
And speaking of the Kherson region, it does appear as if Ukrainian forces, as part of their counteroffensive measures, have been able to recapture some villages that were previously under Russian occupation. But I want to turn our attention to the front line, because the mayor of Kharkiv said that Russia attacked some of its city infrastructure with S-300 missiles. Now, that's something that VOA cannot independently verify. But what can you share with us about what's known about additional fighting on the front lines?
Russian forces definitely continued their own attacks as well, not only in Kherson region, but of course in the east. In terms of the east part of Ukraine, situation is not that much different from what we see for the past couple of days. The most heavy fightings are happening in the area of Bakhmut, and today the city of Bakhmut was attacked by the Russian forces with missiles. So today early in the morning, Russian forces hit the territory and the building of the hotel in Bakhmut. For the moment, we know about 4 people injured and 1 people killed.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller from Kyiv. The head of the UN delegation at the Joint Coordination Center in Istanbul, overseeing the grain export deal between Russia and Ukraine, Fred Kenye, says the agreement was crucial to ensure global food security. The center, which was unveiled on Wednesday, will oversee the export of Ukrainian grains after a landmark UN deal last week, with the first shipment expected to depart from Black Sea ports within days. Russia and Ukraine signed a deal brokered by Ankara and the United Nations on Friday. It reopens grain and fertilizer exports that have been blocked by war to ease an international food crisis. All vessels pass through Turkish waters, and all parties appointed representatives to the JCC to monitor implementation of the plan. A total of 20 personnel from Ukraine, Russia, Turkey, and the United Nations will work side by side there.
We believe that it's critical to ensuring global food security, so yes, we need to succeed. Certainly, the primary consideration in this initiative is to ensure the safety and safe navigation of merchant vessels. So, of course, all of those considerations will be taken into account.
That's the head of UN delegation at the Joint Coordination Center in Istanbul, Fred Kenye. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov lashed out at Western countries Wednesday as he wrapped up a 4-nation trip to Africa with a stop in Ethiopia's capital. Moscow is seeking to bolster support from African countries who have largely declined to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The West and Washington blame Russia's blockade of Ukrainian ports, attacks and disruption of supply chains as the cause of global food crisis. Lavrov's visit comes as the U.S. announced nearly $500 million in additional aid for drought relief in Ethiopia. Fred Herter reports from the capital Addis Ababa.
The Wednesday news briefing in Addis Ababa. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov denied Western assertions that his country's invasion of Ukraine is responsible for the global surge in food prices. Lavrov said prices were rising before Russia invaded Ukraine in February due to the COVID-19 pandemic and what he called green policies pursued by the West. He also claims that any additional increases in grain prices were the result of American and European sanctions on Russia.
I know that the Western media presents the situation in a totally distorted manner, if only to mention the food crisis, so-called food crisis, as if nothing was of concern before February this year.
Lavrov is on the last leg of an Africa tour that has included Egypt, Uganda, and the Republic of the Congo. He has sought to reassure regional leaders that grain exports through Ukraine's Black Sea ports will resume, while pinning the blame for their halt on the West. Lavrov alleged Wednesday that the sanctions imposed on Russia are a sign that the United States wants a return to what he called a colonial world order.
The West created a system which was based on certain principles: free market, fair competition, sanctity of the private property, presumption of innocence, something else. All these principles have been thrown down the drain when they needed to do what they believe is to punish Russia.
While in Addis, Lavrov met with the Ethiopian Foreign Minister, Demeke Mekonnen. The pair agreed to strengthen cooperation and economic ties, according to state media. There is no indication that Lavrov met with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has not been seen in public lately, or with officials from the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. AU officials told VOA that Lavrov's stop was a bilateral visit between Russia and Ethiopia. Earlier Wednesday, the US government announced a package of $488 million to help Ethiopia with drought relief efforts. Dry weather and conflict have left 30 million Ethiopians in need of aid. Announcing the new funds, Tracy Ann Jacobson, the U.S. Charge d'Affaires in Ethiopia, said weather conditions across the region were the worst in recorded history. The new U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn, Mike Hammer, is expected to arrive in Ethiopia on Wednesday, his first visit to the country, where the U.S. is supporting efforts to mediate between the federal government and rebels from the Tigray region in the north. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
U.S. President Joe Biden has emerged from isolation after a five-day period during which he had COVID-19. We get details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
Speaking for nearly 10 minutes in the White House Rose Garden on Wednesday, President Biden declared himself fully recovered from COVID-19 after he tested negative.
My symptoms were mild, my recovery was quick, and I'm feeling great.
Biden also noted the contrast between his experience with COVID-19 compared to his immediate predecessor, Donald Trump, who became infected before vaccines were available and treatment options were limited.
When my predecessor got COVID, he had to get helicoptered to Walter Reed Medical Center. He was severely ill. Thankfully, he recovered. When I got COVID, I worked from upstairs of the White House in the offices upstairs and for that five-day period.
The president said while the coronavirus is still with us, especially the highly infectious BA5 variant, COVID-19 deaths are down nearly 90% from when he took office in January of 2021 due to widespread vaccinations and Paxlovid, a pill Biden described as a life-saving drug. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Steve. The contest to succeed Boris Johnson as British Prime Minister is down to two candidates. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, policy towards China has become a key issue on the campaign trail.
Former Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the current Foreign Secretary Liz Truss are vying to take over from Boris Johnson, who resigned as Prime Minister earlier this month. Fewer than 200,000 Conservative Party members will vote to choose Britain's next Prime Minister in the coming weeks. Taxation and inflation have dominated the domestic agenda, but on foreign policy, China has dominated. In a recent televised debate, Truss said she would crack down on Chinese-owned companies like TikTok.
And we should be limiting the amount of technology exports we do to authoritarian regimes.
The Foreign Secretary pledged a tougher stance against Beijing.
after the appalling abuses in Xinjiang, after the terrible actions on Hong Kong. And the most recent outrage, which is China working with Russia and essentially backing them in the appalling war in Ukraine, we have to take a tougher stance.
Truss's rival, Rishi Sunak, has called China the number one threat to domestic and global security.
And as Prime Minister, I'll take a very, very robust view on making sure that we do stand up for our values and we protect ourselves against those threats, because that's the right thing to do for our security.
The candidates are appealing to a particular electorate, notes analyst Steve Tsang, director of the University of London's SOAS China Institute.
The Conservative Party members are more concerned about China policy than the general public in the UK as a whole. And this, I think, is the reason why the two prime minister contenders engage in a debate on China, but they were only focused on one single issue: who is softer on China, rather than what the UK's China strategy should be.
Matching policies as prime minister with the rhetoric of the campaign may be a challenge, says Tsang.
Some commitments can be achieved relatively quickly. For example, the closing of Confucius Institutes articulated by Sunak. The real issue here is whether Liz Truss will, as prime minister, repeat what she had said if she continues to use the description genocide on Xinjiang. Is going to make relationship between the UK and China very, very difficult indeed.
Beijing criticised the language used in the British leadership debate. Zhao Lijian, the Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson, criticised the language used in the British leadership debate. He said, "I would like to urge certain British politicians not to make an issue out of China or hype the so-called China threat." The result of the vote will be announced September 5th. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In other news, hard-won progress against HIV has stalled, putting millions of lives at risk. That's according to an alarming report Wednesday on how the collision with the COVID-19 pandemic and other global crises have set back efforts to end AIDS. Declines in new infections are leveling off, cases are rising in some spots. COVID disrupted HIV care and widened inequalities that left already vulnerable people at more risk. Experts are calling for fast efforts to start getting back on track. The report from UNAIDS was released at International AIDS Conference in Montreal. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. A UN monitoring committee is calling for the repeal of the Hong Kong's national security law, saying it undermines the fundamental rights and freedoms of the people in the territory. The UN Human Rights Committee, which monitors the implementation of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, has just issued its concluding observations on the situation in Hong Kong. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
The 18-member committee says it is deeply concerned about the overly broad interpretation of Hong Kong's national security law. It notes the law was passed by the National People's Congress of China without consultation with the people of Hong Kong. Committee Vice Chair Christopher Arif Bolkin says more than 200 people, including 12 children, have been arrested since the enactment of the law in 2020 on grounds of endangering national security.
The committee underscored the shortcomings of the NSL, including the lack of clarity of the term national security and the possibility of transferring cases from Hong Kong to mainland China, which is not a state party to the covenant, for investigation, prosecution, trial, and execution of penalties.
Britain handed control of Hong Kong to China in 1997 under the one country, two systems principle. The agreement, which is enshrined in the so-called Basic Law, protects rights such as freedom of speech and assembly in the territory for 50 years. China replaced the agreement 23 years after it was enacted with the National Security Law. Hong Kong is a signatory of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights under the Basic Law. As such, Bulkin says, the territory must abide by the obligations, the rights, and freedoms prescribed in the document. Though China is not a party to the covenant, he says the human rights enshrined in the treaty are paramount. He says local legislation cannot derogate from the human universal rights protected in the agreement.
The NSL, for instance, asserts alongside that a jurisdiction that tends to override or could threaten that primacy. And so that's one of the first reasons why we called for its repeal, because it's incompatible with preserving the rights and freedoms under the covenant.
The committee expresses concern about the chilling effects the NSL is having on civil society organizations. It says many trade unions and student unions under threat from the law have relocated or ceased to operate. The independent experts note the Hong Kong government has not provided assurances that civil society representatives who have participated in the review would be protected from charges under the NSL. They say they have asked authorities not to prosecute them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Isolated, poverty-stricken and war-torn Idlib is called Syria's, quote, last remaining rebel stronghold, unquote. But most people there rely on emergency aid to stay alive. Locals say despair has become endemic in northwestern Syria, with increasing number of young people taking their own lives. For VOA, Muneb Taim has this report from Idlib with Hera Murdoch in Istanbul.
More than 2 years ago, in the last months of a nearly year-long offensive on Idlib province, almost a million people fled their homes in the largest mass exodus of the Syrian war. Former rebel fighter Salim al-Anjouki was among the displaced after his city was taken by Syrian government forces. Along with his wife and eight children, he eventually found a place in this crowded camp closer to Idlib city. The next year, he lost his eldest son.
My son committed suicide. Mohammed Salam al-Anjouki was 17 years old. When we were displaced to this camp, he had psychological problems. He could not accept the situation.
Despite growing up in a war zone, Mohammed studied in school and learned to fix cars to help feed his family. In the camp, he had to drop out of school and work was scarce. His father says he felt he had no future. Doctors say suicide among youth in Idlib is becoming increasingly common.
Suicide has increased in Syria over the last 10 years, but it has been especially prevalent during the past 2 years, where we have noticed an increase in cases.
Statistics are shaky at best in northwestern Syria, but aid group Syria Response Coordinator Team says it has counted 33 suicide attempts as of June 5th in Idlib, which is nearly 40% more than the entirety of 2021. Mental health experts say the cause of suicide is often rooted in the deep poverty and isolation that is widespread in Idlib.
People do not have the resources to adapt to the massive cost of living and high rents compared to their incomes. This is an important factor in the problem.
She says harsh conditions have also led to an increase in psychological problems, such as depression, in addition to domestic violence and drug use. Al-Anjouki says the pain of the loss of his son has not gotten better with time.
My younger son says he imagines playing with his brother and hearing him say, "Where are you hiding?" My wife holds his clothes and cries for him, while I, even now, can't accept that he died.
He says conditions have not gotten easier since Mohammed died. Idlib is now considered the last rebel stronghold and is sporadically attacked as it continues to sink deeper into abject poverty. For Monib Team in Idlib, Syria, Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the Russian state-owned news agency TASS, Yuri Borisov, chief of Roscosmos, the country's space agency, said at a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin that Russia will leave the International Space Station project after 2024. It will then focus on creating its own national orbital station. The Roscosmos chief said in the TASS article that, quote, we will definitely fulfill all our obligations to our partners, but the decision to withdraw from this station after 2024 has been made, unquote. In a Washington Post article, Robin Gattens, NASA's director of the ISS, said that the space agency had not received any official word from Russia, but that, quote, we'll be talking more about their plan moving forward, unquote. NASA recently announced plans to extend the mission of the ISS until 2030. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including reaction to former President Donald Trump's return to Washington, D.C. for his first major political and policy address since he left office. His appearance comes in light of new evidence from the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
And to all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and television programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joe Biden has committed to curtailing the use of landmines worldwide. This policy change reflects the president's belief that these weapons have a disproportionate impact on civilians, including children, long after fighting has stopped. The new commitment will align U.S. landmine policy outside of the Korean Peninsula with the key requirements of the Ottawa Convention, the international treaty prohibiting the use, stockpiling, production, and transfer of anti-personnel landmines. The unique circumstances on the Korean Peninsula and the U.S. commitment to the defense of the Republic of Korea preclude the United States from changing anti-personnel landmine policy on the Korean Peninsula at this time. The United States will not develop, produce, or acquire anti-personnel landmines, nor export or transfer anti-personnel landmines, except when necessary for activities related to mine destruction or removal and for the purpose of destruction. The U.S. will not use anti-personnel landmines outside the Korean Peninsula, nor assist, encourage, or induce anyone outside the context of the Korean Peninsula to engage in activity that would be prohibited by the Ottawa Convention. The United States will seek to destroy anti-personnel landmines and their stockpiles not required for the defense of the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. will continue to pursue material and operational solutions that would allow the United States to accede to the Ottawa Convention while at the same time ensure the United States' ability to meet its alliance commitments. The United States' actions are in sharp contrast to Russia's actions in Ukraine, said Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Political Military Affairs Stan Brown. In Ukraine, there is compelling evidence that Russian forces are using explosive munitions, including landmines, in an irresponsible manner, which is causing extensive harm to civilians and damage to vital civilian infrastructure there. The United States is proud to lead the world in conventional weapons destruction. We've invested more than $4.2 billion in more than 100 countries since 1993 to promote international peace and security through our conventional weapons destruction programs, said Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Brown. We'll continue this important work and remain committed to continuing partnerships to address the humanitarian impacts of anti-personnel landmines.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.